welcome again to the CDOT show. I am C. Trent Rosecrans, one of the Red Speed writers at the Cincinnati Enquirer and the eponymous host of the CDOT show. Sorry, this has been it's been a long second half of the season. Not a lot of people clamoring for too much more Reds coverage, but you know, there's still baseball being played, and there's still a lot of good baseball being played. And I'm talking with I'm going to keep this intro short today because Lonnie and I went long. My guest today is Lonnie Wheeler, author of a new book called Intangible: The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. You know, the things that a lot of people like to make fun of, like, you know, grit, chemistry, character. It's kind of an interesting discussion and a talk with Lonnie. Lonnie is not a Luddite who doesn't believe in sabermetrics and the such. He gets into that and kind of talks about some of the misunderstandings that some people have about his book and what he's written and kind of his findings. And that's an interesting, fun talk. Lonnie and I, as you will hear, I'm leaving in a lot of pretty much everything just because it was a fun talk with Lonnie, and leaving in some of the intros because I consider Lonnie a friend and a mentor, and he's also a fantastic writer. So the new book is Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games, and here's me and Lonnie.
Set here. So I will record an intro. That's where I'll say all the bad things, and then I'll come in and pretend I like you. How's that sound?
Disingenuous enough to work.
I mean, it's kind of genuine in its disingenuousness.
Yeah, well, it's you best kind.
There's something to be said for that. It's honest dishonesty. I'm actually going to check the level here. But, yeah. So, Lonnie, can you say something?
I'm testing your podcast.
Perfect. So, here with the great Lonnie Wheeler, author.
He's already...
I'm already in disingenuous, yes. Suspending disbelief. No, I do like that the directions to your house that you gave me, I thought I was... I mean, that's what a serial killer would send.
It got you here.
It got me here. Is it going to get me out?
It's not like, on the main
there's
road.
There's three mailboxes and a gravel road across from it.
And once you enter that gravel road... You
know, yeah, all's lost.
Well, I got the dogs in for you, so you ought to be grateful.
I, you know, there are certain people I'd rather talk to dogs than people. So, dogs are great. So, Lonnie Wheeler, the newest book is Intangible. This is something you've been working on for a long time.
It seems like forever, actually. Yeah, I started looking into it and researching it really in 2008. But, you know, there were delays and things happened and... there's one point when I went, I thought I was just about done with it, and I waited 9 months to hear back from the publishing house. And so I was at that point doubting whether this was going to get published, but there were good reasons. And I would have liked it to come out a couple of years ago. By the time it was over, I had written a lot about Dusty, for instance, and he was gone. Things like that happen, and it's not newspaper where you're writing for the next day. But yeah, it's been a long time. But I ended up doing another book almost simultaneously that will be out next month, which seems odd. But this was one that I feel strongly about and have wanted to do for even longer than I've been working on it.
I mean, I remember talking to you about the idea and the genesis of this, even when we both had jobs.
Yeah, that would have been 2007.
Yeah.
I think anybody who has followed the game forever has a place in their heart for intangibles and a belief in that these things, these qualities that we all talk about and grow up with have an effect. And I think, you know, everybody, they're dear to everybody to certain degrees, but I really wanted to kind of demystify the concept of intangibles and make it real. And by tracking a team for a few years, and the Reds were the handiest, and of course, since I had the great beat writing in the Enquirer, that I could chronicle everything that happened.
Why are you smirking?
So I followed the Reds from closely every game from 2008 to 2012, just looking for those things, looking for ways that the team is affected by things that don't show up in the box score or in advanced metrics.
Right. And I mean, I guess that's kind of the whole idea is that those, and I don't know that even the metrics people would disagree with that.
You know, I don't think they do. And that's, it's an interesting.
Are we almost getting this false dichotomy of, yeah. You know, there's a false, like butting of heads and it's not.
The disconnect. And to me, where it comes into play is leading sabermetricians, you know, Bill James, you did an interview with Bill James where that I referenced in the book where he talks about anybody who doesn't pay attention to the non-measurable stuff is missing it. He used the term as childish.
Right.
And I think, yeah, any scientist doesn't think that, will not believe that the research that he has presented ends the case. I mean, the whole premise of science is to be receptive of whatever else may come to bear. And sabermetricians, I believe, do recognize that there's a little bit of space there, a little bit of wiggle room for something other than what's demonstrated numerically. But where I've seen and have taken exception to is not necessarily the sabermetricians themselves and their work, but those who follow them so ardently.
It's not Jesus, it's the Christians.
Subscribe. There you go. good way to say it. And people who overstate it and overvalue it. I don't, in any way, and anybody who reads the book will see, I don't diminish the work of sabermetrics at all. I think it's been incredible, fantastic, the way it's enlightened our understanding of the game and the way we evaluate it. But some of the subscribers will say that that's the end of the story, that if you're evaluating two players, say, for a trade, this is what I see on message boards all the time, and one player has a 359 on base percentage and the other one has a 341, that's the end of the story, that the guy with the higher OBP is the guy who belongs in your lineup, and there's nothing more to be said about it. Well, there's a lot more to be said about it. Some of it is statistical. There are other ways to measure and evaluate players, but some of it is not. And so what I write about is what a player can do to aid his club, to make his club better able to win games in ways that we don't see in the tables of numbers, both on the field and off. I concentrated on off. The stuff on the field, we can see. We don't measure. Some of it's getting measured, some isn't. But we can recognize when an outfielder backs up another outfielder and saves an error when the guy bobbles it. When an outfielder cuts off a ball in the gap and holds a double to a single or saves a base that way. When a base runner takes a secondary lead and goes first to third consequently as a result. When two outfielders talk to each other so they don't collide and drop a ball. All those things, hitting behind the runner, bunting, what they call the little things, are visible. But the stuff that people are doing in the clubhouse is not visible. When a veteran is putting his arm around a rookie's shoulder after a bad game and encouraging him, say, look, you know, I've had games like that every year for the last 14. You know, it gives the guy a little heart. When you know, if I don't know if this happens, but if Joey Votto, for instance, is watching video with Eugenio Suarez and shows him how he approaches this pitcher or what this pitcher does, that can be helpful to a younger player. There's just countless things that players can do to make other players better, and that's what I'm writing about.
So it's so funny. I mean, have you seen some of the backlash? I've seen there's backlash just about it from people who haven't read it. It just seems like that's kind of...
I expect that. I haven't seen a lot. I did see a review or two on Amazon that people write themselves I mean, they say they've read the book, but it's just the very concept that you're recognizing something other than numbers,
right,
that people disagree with, and which is their disagreement is what I disagree with. Yeah. But I, in those cases, my response is always, show me a sentence or a paragraph that you want to take issue with, and I'll be more than happy to talk about that. And
well, I have this highlight. No,
But yeah, there is. Beyond that, there's been some that I haven't seen.
I think there's more snark, but I don't know if you know that happens on the internet occasionally.
Have you found that?
No.
But I haven't seen it related to the book. Maybe I'm not looking in the right places.
I've just seen a couple things where it's like, well, the people who are all excited about Lonnie Wheeler's new book, and it's like, well, hey, at least you're putting your name out there.
Well, I'll have to look for that a little
while. No, you don't. you've done a lot of baseball books.
Most of them collaborations, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you've done these baseball books. What is it about baseball more than other sports that draws you to it?
I mean, it's the sport, well, not everybody. The sport I grew up with and the sport a lot of us grows up with. And it's that daily thing, the progress of the seasons and the players you relate to and you know, sharing it with your family. But also, baseball leaves so much to the imagination. There's so much you can see and identify and so much that you can't. It's provocative in that way. Baseball lends itself to lore. It's interesting. And I think ironic that in this country, baseball is our game that probably more than any of the other majors relates to history. Mm-hmm. It's an historic game, you know. And yet, compare that to European history, and I mean, in other parts of the world, they say we have no history.
Right.
We're a young country. But that's what it is to us. The relationship between baseball and society, I think, has been much deeper than other sports. You know, through Jackie Robinson and the Black Sox scandal and all the issues that have arisen over the years. Baseball sets a tone for the country, and it always has.
Do you think that still happens?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, probably in ways that we don't see as well now.
The intangibles.
You know, we'll probably, I don't know what, when people look back at this era, how baseball and Americana will be entangled, but I'm sure it will. One thing, the rise of Latino players, and that's not only baseball, that's social and American also. I think baseball probably has had a leading role in that now with Cuba open. I think that'll be another chapter that's being made now.
Because you covered, I mean, we were at the Post together, and you were a general columnist. You've done all sorts of other sports. Is baseball your favorite sport, or is it just your favorite to write about? And I think there's a difference.
Yeah, it is. It's the one that comes most naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember being in first grade, and my teacher or something just not finding it odd that this little kid could understand baseball so much or you know, be apprised of baseball so much. It's just, you know, it's just always sort of been at my fingertips. But my daughter played college basketball, and I always loved basketball, and you know, would be happy to write basketball. I did write a book on the culture of basketball in Kentucky. I've written a football book on the local high school game, something that interests me. And, you know, other sports do attract me, but baseball just seems to come more naturally.
And it's always there. I don't know. That's one of the beauties of it to me, has always been that you can always count on it. It just always seems to be there, day in and day out.
You know, not only for 6 months of the year, but, you know, baseball, to me, is the most active off-season.
Mm-hmm. Trust me, I know.
Anybody who's deeply interested in the game is just as interested in what's happening personnel-wise, roster-wise, in the off-season as they are during the season. So it's probably the most year-round game of ours.
Even though we get hit over the head with football. day in and day out.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people would make the same claims for football that I do for baseball, and I understand that, but I think, you know.
Theirs all seem to be tied to dates, though. You know, there's like that first day of free agency, everybody does it. Whereas you got to wine and dine a baseball player.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, does football really have a hot stove league? Does basketball have a hot stove league? That's a baseball thing.
Yeah. I mean, in trades.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of it because you don't really get trades in football.
No, not as much. And trades are, it's an area that really invite and engage the fan. Mm-hmm. Every fan, you know, thinks he can make a better trade.
And then when a trade is made, like, well, one that's very central in your book, the Scott Rowland trade. I hated it for the Reds. Just hated it. I was wrong.
In ways, and you know, Dougherty said the same thing, and later wrote columns about how he had changed his opinion of that trade. Understandably, because that trade went against the grain for a team in that situation. It was a young team rebuilding. You don't go out and get a 30-something-year-old third baseman who's had clashes with previous managers, not to mention a bad back and shoulder. You know, that's not rebuilding, but Jocony did have the wisdom to understand that in rebuilding with young players, they needed somebody to show them how to play the game, to show the way. And Rowland was the perfect guy for that, in spite of some issues that he'd had with previous teams.
Scott was a real interesting guy. Did you get to talk to him much for this?
Yeah, it struck me as a very normal guy with a great dry sense of humor.
He's one of the funniest people I've met in the game.
I thought in a different way, Adam Dunn was hilarious.
Yeah,
too,
yeah.
In a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, one was highbrow comedy, one was more working man comedy. So Scott he's just kind of a different cat, and it was. The one thing I always got with Scott was he didn't talk all the time, but when he talked, everybody listened.
Yeah. I hadn't realized at the time, but talking to one of the younger players, how they called him Chief Big Fist, which demonstrates sort of their awe of him. And everybody says, yeah, he's not the kind of guy that would walk up and chat somebody up or make unsolicited corrections. But if somebody didn't take the extra base or didn't hustle to running out of ground ball, all he had to do was look at him. Or I think there was some player who didn't run a ground ball out, and he walked up and said, "You okay? Is everything all right with you?" And the guy, you know, quickly understood what he was talking about and gets the message across. I think he'll make a good manager if he chooses that.
Yeah, I don't think he will. He doesn't seem to a guy.
He's retreated to family life.
Yeah, he wants to be a dad, you know, and I think a lot of, you know, I think managing is one of those things when you talk about what goes into intangible differences. I think managing is full of that and what we see and what we don't see.
Yeah, I think that's what managing is largely about.
I think what we see is 10 to 15%.
Yeah,
at the most.
I'm glad to hear you say that because it's so frustrating. And there are managers that I disagree with moves they make. I'll watch a pitcher getting knocked around and say, "Get him out of there. Can't you see that he's lost it?" And they'll go for two or three more batters, double, triple, and game's over. And it's frustrating that you know, you can. It's easy to disagree with the moves that you see. But what you don't see is a way a manager has guided or counseled a player. He's put him in the lineup in the right situation for that player, there have been studies too lately, and Sabermetrics has taken up this cause in that way too. They have studies that have looked at managers' effect on players that I think shed a lot of light on it. And by extension, managers and also coaches, hitting and pitching coaches, it's presumed that they can make a difference with players by counseling them and leading them, advising them in the right way. So if that's true, if you can make a player better while not being on the field, if a manager and coaches can do that, why can't a player do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
If that thing exists, then it's available to players, to veterans. And it just it goes to reason that players somehow are affecting their teammates. Baseball in that way is a very sort of social, communicable thing. They're flying together. They're together for more than six months with spring training. Flying together. They're in the clubhouse every day for 3 hours before the game. Then a lot of them going out to dinner together. It's social by nature. And socially, things will rub off. Players' work ethics will be revealed to other players. I thought, to Jockety's credit, when he took over as general manager and understood the need for a culture change, they'd had however many, I forget, losing seasons in a row, basically a decade of it.
I guess since 99 was the last one, or it was 2000.
Or it might have been 2000, Griffey's first,
Griffey's first year.
And it wasn't working. In spite of, Griffey wasn't the player here that he had been, mostly because of his injuries to his legs. But he was still a superstar, and Adam Dunn was producing prolifically. They had two big-time players. It wasn't working. And because of the stature of Griffey and Dunn, they were going to be leaders whether they wanted to or not. And it really wasn't their interest. Their MO wasn't to just go out there and break neck around the bases. Griffey couldn't do it because of his legs. Dunn weighed 270 pounds or whatever. He had leg trouble too that he played through.
And back.
And Dunn was a gamer much more than I think people gave him credit for.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the kind of energy that Jockety and many general managers would choose to build around. And so they made the tough decision to trade their two best highly regarded stars and rebuild the culture with younger players, and it worked. I find it part of that lag time of a book coming out years after you think you're done with it. Well, now they've had two dreadful seasons.
I know. Is that one of those things where you look back and you're like, oh, the book? I mean, there's so much centers on the success of the Reds, and now here they are battling for the worst record.
Sure, it's something I wish hadn't happened. And Dusty's gone, and I closely examined. It doesn't change the essence of it, because you're still following a team and seeing what influences come to bear. They rebuild the culture, and the last season that I addressed in the book was 2012. They were rated as the organization of the year. I mean, everything was hunky dory there, and then it turned south the last couple of years. And people say, does that annul? Well, no. It's more reason for observation. You look and see what happened. One of the things I think occurred is that people talk about chemistry among players in the clubhouse, and that's a whole different subject. But I also think there's a chemistry of talent mm-hmm. that needs to be recognized, which I think the Reds have lacked. In spite of a lot of very productive players, they have typically lacked something like a leadoff hitter or a cleanup hitter or a left fielder or a shortstop. There's always been one or two glaring deficiencies that they've neglected to properly address and satisfactorily address. And I think that's held them back a little bit. Also, the players in those years who were good influences, who really raised the culture. Roland's gone, and he was the leading guy. But when you think about all the other players who were no longer here, who were the best characters, the leaders of that team? Wasn't only Roland. I thought Johnny Gomes was a guy who just has a tremendous influence. His energy, players always knew that Gomes had their back.
Well, the other thing with Johnny, you just look, people keep trading for Johnny Gomes despite the numbers. I think that's probably Exhibit A. As you look at Johnny Gomes, the contract that he was given by both the A's and then by the Red Sox, that Red Sox contract was basically, we want you to be Johnny Gomes.
Yeah, exactly. Teams are recognizing that. that those players have value. Brandon McCarthy had said, I forget the number he used, but Gomes, he said, and one other player were responsible for 20 extra wins for the well, 20 wasn't might have been not have been the number.
And you're talking about McCarthy, who's one of the most stat heavy
exactly
players around. The A's gave him a big contract, and they're of course the Moneyball team. And then you know the Red Sox, who are very influenced by that as well,
and everywhere
and play Bill James.
Gomes ends up in the postseason every year. Orlando Cabrera was another guy. Like
oh,
that.
Yeah.
He only spent 1 year here, but I think he had a very, particularly on a guy like Votto, I think he had a good influence. He's gone. You know, who are the
and
other?
Orlando Cabrera, you look at, there are certain guys I always think you look at, how these guys always end up on playoff teams.
Yeah.
Gomes, Orlando Cabrera was on so
right.
many.
Is it a coincidence? Yeah.
Rowan.
And from those teams, those two, or those three, Cabrera, Gomes, and Rowland were obvious culture tone-setting guys. Bronson Arroyo, very much that kind of guy. Ryan Hannigan, very much that kind of guy. Cordero played that role for the bullpen.
Very much so.
So did Arthur Rhodes.
I think Cordero is one of those underappreciated people in this organization's history.
I agree. He was
speaking of deals I hated when they made it.
You know, Dusty always
man,
said...
Man, I don't know anything.
One of Dusty's managing philosophies was to have a leader at every position group. He wanted somebody on the bench who mm-hmm. could lead those guys, somebody in the outfield, on the infield, a starting pitcher, and a relief pitcher to sort of take charge of their group. And I think Cordero and Arthur Rhodes, I think, played a big role in that, too. You know, and Hannigan was so good with not just his work ethic, which excelled, but the way he worked with pitchers and took responsibility for studying hitters and sharing that with pitchers. He kept notebooks on hitters. He went to pitchers' meetings. The way he could communicate and reach pitchers was very valuable. Ryan Ludwig was a great guy, and he presented humor. You need. Mm-hmm. There are such. I mean, it's a long season. Guys get down. You need a little levity. Cabrera, I think, supplied that when he was here.
Very much so.
And Ludwig did. And this year, Sam LeCure has not been around. He's a guy that sort of raises the spirits in the clubhouse. All those guys who were sort of the heart of their maybe not statistically, but socially and morally and spiritually, those guys were the heart of those pennant winning division winning teams. They're all gone. And so is Dusty, who emphasized he was a people person to the hilt.
Well, that's the thing I think with Dusty. I always say that 10 to 15% is what you see. That other 85% is what Dusty excelled at.
He was as
at.
Good as anybody.
Yeah,
at that stuff.
That's
yeah.
where he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, absolutely. I found it interesting that one of the studies that I read that measured the effect of managers and coaches. Actually focused on Dusty when he was with the Giants, how he numerically, statistically demonstrated that players who came under the umbrella of Dusty Baker became better hitters. When they were better when they came to the Giants under Dusty's stewardship, and then fell off. You know, comparing their time with Dusty to their time with other people, much as Cardinals pitchers with Dave Duncan,
mm-hmm.
Very similar thing. There's kind of a mystique to the way the Cardinals seem to be able to acquire players and they're suddenly good. There's got to be something that's making that happen. I thought it was La Russa for a long time, but then he's gone. Pujols was, I think, a tremendous team guy. He's gone, and they're still doing it. One thing that Dave Duncan did
he's gone.
But I thought something he did was indicative of their culture. When a pitcher has his the day off between starts when he's throwing, his work day between starts, Duncan would gather all the other starting pitchers to come down to the bullpen with him and would have them comment and remark, critique each other as they threw their bullpens. Allowing them to benefit from each other's knowledge. I mean, that's part of, I think, the culture that the Cardinals were developing and ways that coaches and managers can influence players.
You wish you were living closer to St. Louis when you wrote this book?
And, you know, it's, baseball's funny that way. I grew up a Cardinal fan, and you know, I just remember sitting, you know, in movie theaters, or I won't say church, but places where I'm supposed to be focused on something, working out the Cardinal lineups and that sort of thing in the off season. Yeah, I had the Cardinals in my blood, but after, I don't know how long it takes. I think it'd be an interesting study how long after you move somewhere that you become more acclimated to the other team. And I think with being working at the paper and being in the Reds clubhouse, you get to know those guys.
Right.
And they're the team that comes on TV when you turn it on. So, yeah, I don't feel that affinity for the Cardinals that I did.
I'm just saying that, I mean, for their success.
Yeah, Cardinals and Giants. And but, you know, we've certainly been able to observe the Cardinals enough playing the Reds and then in the postseason. Yeah. But they've been remarkable, haven't they? I was talking.
I'm looking forward to Howard Megdahl has a book coming out. Do you know Howard at all?
I know the name, but. Yeah.
Howard has a book coming out in the Cardinal way.
Oh, really?
It's going to be really. I think it's coming out soon. I'm not even sure when.
After Intangible came out, I was contacted by somebody with an organization in the American League, sort of interested in the philosophies and the material that went into it. And he said, yeah, we're all trying to figure out what the Cardinals do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure they are. And the Giants.
The Giants are fascinating to me because Sabian is this thing. His reputation as being kind of the anti, you know, you have the two different sides in the Bay Area almost.
Right in the Bay Area.
And Sabian, Billy Beane is seen as the genius, whereas Sabian seems to be the guy who gets lucky. Except it can't be luck.
And luck is a subject, is a whole different subject.
Right, also. But I mean, that comes, luck plays a part in things.
Yeah, and an interesting, too, when, you know, in the wake of Moneyball, and Oakland has succeeded, has overachieved, you know, according to its economic station. But everybody idolizes and reveres Billy Beane for what he's done. You know, he's the model that a lot of fans, admirers of Sabermetrics, look up to. But is anybody putting Brian Sabian on that same plateau? Ought to be.
Yeah.
Luck is to me occupies the territory that I think intangibles ought to be claiming to some extent.
Right.
Because luck.
What is the difference?
Well, first of all, sabermetrics will predict and account for lots of things, but it won't always take you to the final victory total. And so, you know, that room in between, that space, that territory is sabermetricians and followers of it attribute it to luck. What can't be quantified, the rest is luck. That's oversimplifying the way it's observed, but that's the essence of it. And there's no question there is a lot of luck involved in the game. I mean, you can hit the Dickens out of a ball, hit a blistering line drive 300 feet right at the left fielder and you're out. You hit it the same thing, not quite as well, 240 feet, and, you know, you might have a double, you know. So
you hit it in Cincinnati, it's out. You hit it in LA, it's an out.
Yeah, I mean, luck is everywhere in the game. You know, umpires' calls, injuries, slow rollers, it's omnipresent. And it has an effect. There's no question it does. But I think a lot of what can't be quantified, what occupies that space between calculus, the expectation of algorithmically, and the outcome, some of that is the intangible stuff that you can't quantify. And that's sort of the area that I would like to carve out and have recognized for intangibles, what's now ascribed to luck.
Well, how much of our disagreements over these things are just, you know, come down to the wording we use. Because really, it sounds like unquantifiable, luck, and tangible. We're all talking about the same.
It's the same turf.
Same ball.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the same kind of thing. And we're getting down to semantics almost.
Well, we are, but it's also.
But I mean, I guess most arguments do come down to semantics.
It's deliberate choices. Mm-hmm. Because I think if you ascribe it all to luck, as many followers of analytics do, it's making a statement that something is beyond the control of us as observers and quantifiers. But if you attribute the same thing to intangibles, you're recognizing that something else is in play other than just what we've observed and quantified. And sabermetricians will say, and I agree, that anything that you do, if it does have an effect, it will show up in the numbers. And I agree. I can't disagree with that. Yeah, if it has an effect, because we're all going toward the win total.
Mm-hmm.
Victories, and that's based on the runs you score and the runs you give up, so forth. So we're all in basic agreement there. But the numbers, while the intangibles have to show up somewhere, the difference is they don't always show up with the guy who's responsible for them.
Right.
They're showing up, you know, I call them second level statistics. Somebody's making somebody else better. I always think that the extreme examples are the most informative, because they state the case more clearly. But one I like to use is when Homer Bailey was sent down to AAA earlier in his career, struggling, and one of the Louisville pitchers was Justin Lear, who was considerably older than Bailey. Obviously, not a former first-round draft choice. Doesn't have any of the talent or a lot of the talent stuff that Bailey does, but was dominating AAA, was succeeding. And Bailey had observed this, that Bailey had struggled a little bit in AAA, and here Lear was proceeding as maybe the best pitcher in the league. And Bailey's watching this, and how do you do it? And he approached Lear in the outfield before a game after watching Lear pitch well the night before and got to talking, and Lear showed him a grip for a split-finger fastball. Bailey, very talented guy, could pick that up and adopted it, and it worked for him. He developed an off-speed pitch with that split finger, and it made him a better pitcher. He got to the big leagues quickly. he succeeded. He picked it up. Well, so you know, Homer Bailey will maybe finish the season with his 3.32 ERA, you know, good pitcher, you know, in the top half in the league. Justin Lear can only get himself a cup of coffee in the big leagues. But does that mean that Lear had no value on that roster? Well, you know, he's maybe 40 points of Homer Bailey's ERA. Right. That's an oversimplification, but he had an effect that doesn't show up on his. It shows up in the numbers, mm-hmm. but what he did shows up on Bailey's numbers rather than his. And yeah, I mean, Bailey took responsibility. He's the one who had to learn it and do it and take it seriously. Sure, he should get credit for that, but somebody else was involved too.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest thing you're saying. I mean, that goes beyond baseball. Doesn't this go beyond baseball?
Of course it does. And corporations.
Like, I mean, you know, when we were at the Cincinnati Post, when I came aboard, it just goes higher.
You raised all the boats.
But I think about it like, you know, I just think of like in a newsroom when you have the people that people are like, oh, hey, Lonnie's here. Or, you know, or sometimes I'm a person, I love to bounce my ideas off people. And I'll be writing a story and I'll say, hey, I've been thinking about this. What do you think? And one of the things I always appreciated about you, you would come back and go, well, did you think about this? And those are things, I always had good conversations with you, and I think you made my end product better.
Well, you know, why is it that we're reluctant to acknowledge effects like that in baseball? And every corporation acknowledges that. I mean, companies will spend good money to send their people on retreats to bond better. They've studied and determined that the attitude and culture in the workplace is maybe the most dramatic and vital determinant in their company's bottom line. The business world recognizes the value of this communicable aspect of people working next to each other. Mm-hmm. Does it not exist in baseball? Of course it does. Baseball is a workplace, just like any corporate office. And so people do help each other. They make each other better. And that's the essence of this. And you know, it's the term I use for all of it. The communicable aspect, the playing the game the right way is teamship. To me, that's a term that just helps to define what we're talking about.
Right, because it's not always about the leader. It's about who contributes to the team.
Yeah, right. And it doesn't have to be the superstar or even the guy who's making the most noise in the clubhouse, but just somebody who, you know, Justin Lehrer was none of those things, for instance.
I always think of...
I think Corky Miller had a big influence.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking there's a great story a couple of years ago. They're in spring training. Some young guy's signing autographs. They walk away and kind of complains about all these people signing, asking for his autograph. Corky looks at him and just goes, "If you don't like it, play worse."
That guy's got to be a manager soon.
Oh, he's a guy that I think is such... He would be a great manager.
I remember it might have been the last year in Sarasota, excuse me. Just briefly, in maybe a minute, walking past the field where Corky... And I was not too familiar with Corky at this time. Just walk past one of the fields where they're working on some infield thing, and Corky is catching, and he's out in front of the plate instructing everybody and raising everybody's spirit, just raising the energy of the workout, just being very involved. And you could tell in just one quick brush with this guy that here's somebody using his position as a catcher, which is probably the principal area where players can influence others, making the most of that. And it's easy to see in a minute that this guy, not one, has a great influence on the team, and two, ought to be a manager someday.
Why is it? Do you think that's why catchers are so often managers, successful managers?
Sure. And they deal
with everybody.
Yeah, and people say that, you know, a catcher is the only one who's seeing the whole field and understanding the game, watching the game unfold, and there's probably something to that. But catcher, more than anybody, has a responsibility to communicate. That's what it's all about. Every pitch, the catcher is working with this pitcher, whether it's just calling a pitch or understanding if the guy is tired, you know, what his pitchers are doing at the moment, whether he needs a kick in the pants. The other book that I was working with sort of simultaneously with this one that'll be out next month is a third one I've done with Bob Gibson called Pitch by Pitch, where we went through one game. We used the game one of the 1968 World Series when Gibson struck out 17. Just went through every game moment by moment and play by play through the head of Gibson and with his commentary. And one of the overriding themes that came out through all of that is the depth of his relationship with Tim McCarver. I mean, they were a unit. You know, McCarver, to start with, when Gibson had the great year in 68, was the one who suggested before the year started that he begin to throw a backdoor slider, because early in his career, Gibson really couldn't control anything but his fastball. His control got better as the years went on. His breaking stuff got better. And Gibson never had the confidence to throw a breaking ball outside. McCarver saw that he was ready before the 68 season. Says, "Let's work on left-handed batters, bringing that slider in the back door and reaching the outside corner with it." That pitch was the one that made the difference in Gibson's record-setting 68 season more than any other. It was recommended by Tim McCarver. But catchers can do that. They're empowered in that way. I mean, Ryan Hannigan took that very, very seriously.
Very much so.
That was his value.
Plus, he got on base.
That too.
Didn't make out.
Which made him a darling of the sabermetric people. So that's a good marriage. If you can satisfy both crowds, you've got it made in the shade.
It's all Ryan Hannigan. Everybody loves Ryan Hannigan. Yes. You mentioned Bob Gibson. he's one of those guys in baseball history. There's not too many people I've ever, you know, once you get into this business and you do it and you're like, okay, yeah, that's Hank Aaron, that's whoever. I still find Bob Gibson intimidating.
Well, you know, and he would like you to.
It's by design.
Yeah, he cultivates that. I mean, he definitely cultivated it as a player, but it's also consistent with his personality. He'll cut you off. He's very blunt. He'll do it if he disagrees. You know, he'll show disdain for, but it's him. It's his persona, and you know he doesn't expect to be taken too seriously, at least by people he knows well. But I love the guy. I think.
How did you get involved with Bob Gibson? I mean, this will be your third book with Bob.
Yeah, actually, the first one he had started an autobiography with another writer, a fellow in New England, and it wasn't kind of working out. So, and I believe my agent in New York, David Black, was brokering that book, and so he asked me if I wanted to take it over. The writing hadn't begun; it was in the research phase, and so I sort of inherited that one, and you know, got along with Bob. I mean, being insulted doesn't bother me much, you know. When you know it's, you know, I've been around enough clubhouses, enough guys. That's okay. I mean,
yeah.
But I remember calling him on a Saturday. Just needed to fill some holes. And he goes, "What are you doing? Nebraska's playing. You can't be calling me now." "All right, Bob. Talk to you later." But you know, that's just him, and you accept that. That's just his shtick. But he's a generous guy, warm. He doesn't have layers between him, you know, between him and the public and other people like most ball players of that stature do. You can reach him on the phone and he'll call you back, and I just think he's a terrific guy, and so we were able to we did a second book together with Reggie Jackson on the confrontation between a hitter and a pitcher, and then I think the publisher had the idea for this book about tapping into Gibson's knowledge and experience to do a book on just, you know, every pitch in a game, the way he will conduct himself and work through an afternoon of baseball. And we initially I thought to make it a regular season game, just making the point that whatever goes into this, it happens for a pitcher 35 times a year.
Right.
It's not extraordinary, but it's their life. And there was actually a game in Cincinnati that I think it was a 2-1 victory for Gibson that appealed to me for a lot of reasons. Rose was young and bench was there. There's a lot of good characters to deal with. And also I wanted a game that was initially on the road, so we had him pitching the bottom of the ninth.
Right.
Because there's a drama to that. The trouble is there's not video of all those games. And so we ended up using the game one of the 68 series because there was a video available so we could sit down and dissect it, and I could get all his comments going through it a couple times on every pitch and batter. But then he was agreeable. He's to me a great guy to work with.
You've also done, you did I Had a Hammer with Hank Aaron.
That was a long time ago. Yeah. totally different personality. Hank is, I mean, you can tell by the way he presents himself. He's got a laid-back pace. And so, whereas with Gibson, I can sit down and pepper him with questions for an hour and get an hour's worth of material. With Aaron, it was more stretching out the day and kind of doing things different, you know, running some errands and you know, letting him go through his workout, and then we talk for 10 minutes here, go to lunch and talk there and observe him throughout the day, but maybe only get that same hour of tape that you'll get with, you know, Gibson or Mike Piazza that I work with, you know, in an hour. They're all different, but I think the necessity in that kind of relationship is to understand that it's their voice, it's their time, however they want to do it, okay. you know, have at it.
It's just funny. I think of, like, you know, you did book with Hank Aaron, Bob Gibson, Mike Piazza. Wildly different.
Yeah, they are. Well, there's...
I remember talking to you when you started the Piazza book. And then, like, throughout it. This was a guy you like a lot.
Yeah, and you know, when working with Piazza, of course, everybody is curious about what's going to be presented on the steroids issue, because mm-hmm. you know, that the issue of the day, and he's never been directly implicated, yet his name is thrown out there because he was a very low draft choice, guy who didn't run well, didn't have a lot of obvious tools, and yet hit like crazy for all of his time in the big leagues, and so people make that leap, and he was playing in the steroid era. Big, strong guy, so, you know, they're by association. But that's sort of where the role of a collaborator comes in. A journalist who's approaching that story as a beat writer or with more traditional journalism parameters is going to try to hammer through that aspect and try to investigate it. As a collaborator, to me, getting to the essence of it, to the bottom of it, is critical. There's no credibility for the book if you don't, but it's a whole different approach because, mm-hmm. you know, it's his book. It's you tell me what you're good with telling me. I encourage you to tell me everything that's there, so we've got it covered, and so I have confidence in what I'm writing is true. And Mike was great about it, and he opened up and told the whole history of the subject as he regarded it. But it's a different approach. You have to understand that you're representing the subject in that arrangement.
Is there a suspension almost of your journalistic background there, or do you ultimately come to the conclusion that I'm presenting this, but I also my name's on it too?
But the player's name is primary.
It's his. Yeah, I see his. I don't see yours.
Exactly. it's his autobiography, and so you're there to assist. I always look at it as to present his voice. You're writing it in the way that he would if he were a writer, mm-hmm. You know, maintaining the voice and the message. So you don't forget your journalism background, and there's a drive to uncover, you know, every fact, every nuance of the subject, and you hope that the subject is willing to do that. If he's not willing to do that, it's his book, it's his autobiography. Yeah. And so that's what you sign on, is to represent him. You know, I was grateful in the Piazza book that he did disclose. You know, he took that seriously. He felt the same way, that it was important to discuss it thoroughly. So, you know, in the end, I didn't have to suspend any, you know, journalistic standards, because he made it easy for me.
Did you think differently of Mike Piazza after you wrote the book than before?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Just getting to know somebody always has that effect, particularly with Piazza playing on the coasts and being a popular guy, and he was a bachelor for most of his career, and I didn't expect him.
You guys have a similar background.
Yeah. Right. A lot, especially the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have really bonded with him on music, I think.
Yeah.
But that was a disconnect for me. But he kind of coached me through all that. But, you know, what I didn't expect was to arrive in a more down-to-earth relationship with him, because that's not how I saw it. I mean, he was a headline guy, you know, kind of a Hollywood type, certainly when he was in L.A. But yeah, I mean, they become real when you spend a lot of time with them. Mike was another guy. He was the first guy I think I've worked with who would actually initiate conversations. He would think of something we discussed or he wanted to add, and he'd make the call himself and call here volunteering information. And I'm sure as a newspaper, you can appreciate how rare, how valuable that is. What a treasure.
That's amazing.
But yeah, I really felt, I mean, you don't expect to always in that kind of relationship to make a friend, you know, to come out with a friend when you're done with this, because that's not what you're in it for. And there's still a professional relationship there. But I did feel that way with Mike.
Do you think he'll ever get in?
Oh, yeah. I think soon. I hope he gets in the next election. He made a lot of progress. To me, it's a travesty that he's not in. I mean, on the steroid issue, I'm totally satisfied that he's good. Even if you have reservations about that, based on strictly on suspicion, this is America. You know, you're innocent until proven guilty. Nothing has come close to proving him guilty. And so I just don't understand how that can keep him out. If you remove that element, I mean, how can there be any question? He is pretty clearly the best hitting catcher ever. And this is where I think sabermetrics comes into play, and increasingly sophisticated sabermetrics is an asset. His defense was called into question mostly because of his arm.
Right.
Early, a year or two, he had a very good record throwing out base runners, but through the beating that he took, he lost that ability as he went along. He did not throw out a lot of base runners. Well, advanced studies now have shown, the studies that determine and analyze working with pitchers, the effect you have with pitchers, show that not only was he an adequate catcher, he's one of the top 3 to 5 catchers in the game.
Framing, yeah.
He's at the top in catchers in overall defensive value if you take into account his impact with pitchers. And there are ways to do that. You know, people say, well, it depends on what, you know, it's not just catcher's ERA.
No.
Because that would depend on who's pitching. But you can measure catcher's ERA if you have a big enough sample. And with a guy who's around as long enough as Piazza, there is a big enough sample. Compare all the pitchers involved, their ERA with Piazza and their ERA with other catchers. And he comes out at the top of the heap, very close to the top of the heap. And so, you know, given the fact that he's clean, he's the greatest hitting catcher there's ever been, and he grades out very well defensively, what in the world are you thinking not putting him in the Hall of Fame?
You know, are you a voter?
No, I'm not. No, I've never. So,
he was on my ballot.
I don't know how you can even think twice about it, but was he?
Yeah. Oh, easy. And of course, I'm probably more liberal with my vote than most. With the steroid issue, I just go with, all I know is what I saw on the field. And I'm kind of that extreme.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple different extremes, I mean, and I'm that side.
And
so Clemens and Bonds were easy yeses for me.
Okay.
And so Piazza was, Piazza, I think, and Bagwell is in the same area as Piazza, where it's whispers, and, well, he was skinny in the minors, and what happened, and, you know, that whole, I don't believe it, so of course he's guilty, jump to conclusion, that Piazza gets, I think Bagwell gets as well, and both of those guys are easy yeses for me. I think the Hall has kind of screwed some things up.
And, you know, it's interesting working with Piazza and Gibson. They're both players who, if questioned about something like intangibles would really not be there. Say, I don't pay much attention to that. They're more get it done on the field kind of guys, especially Gibson. Piazza, of course, is a catcher, realizes all the other stuff a catcher has to do. But they are, both of them by their examples, can help amplify and illuminate the intangibles question. But they're not among the many, many players who will gush and rave about things you can do off the field about intangible issues. But I think they both apply through observation. You can see what they did. But, you know, many players, that's one of the, and you talked to a couple of players on this subject too. And one of the things in the book that really surprised me and pleased me was how it's a subject that not only players, but managers and general managers light up about. You know, as I'm sure you've experienced in talking to baseball people day after day after day, most of them really trying, as great a guy as you are, they don't want to talk to you. And, you know, particularly in a beat situation, you've got to ask them about their latest injury, about the game that was just played, and you know, it's a lot of stuff they don't want to talk about. And so we're used to players, managers, general managers going through the motions and not really getting into what you're asking them. On this subject on intangibles, they did. Not only the front office people, but players. Carlos Pena was tremendous. Johnny Gomes, Brandon Phillips was very, very good talking about the influence of Roland. Bronson Arroyo was incredible, as he always is.
Yeah, he always is.
I love Bronson Arroyo talking about his experience with the Red Sox, and of course they were a team that very much, it was a culture thing with them when they succeeded, and one of the leaders there was Kevin Millar, who was kind of an ordinary player, but a great character. Arroyo said he would, if he were a general manager, he would pay Kevin Millar $2 million a year just to sit on the bench. Thanks. Nice quote.
I mean, the Red Sox paid Johnny Gomes how much to be a platoon left fielder?
Yeah, exactly. And that's,
and so they were paying him $2 million to sit on the bench.
That was one of the things that initially caught my attention about this subject, about baseball recognizing it. I think it was Buster Olney wrote a piece when Cliff Floyd was signed, I think it was by Tampa Bay.
It was Tampa. He finished his career in Tampa because Lancaster was down there.
But he had been signed previously. Did he play in San Diego? Kevin Towers signed somebody.
I think so, yeah.
As for, I don't know, $800,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And by that time, he was older and broken down. And really, his ability was no greater than a replacement player. A guy you could bring up from the minors for, what's the minimum salary now?
$400,000. $520,000, I think.
And they paid him $300,000 or $400,000 over the minimum salary, knowing that his on-field production was no better than the guy they'd bring up from the minors. So they were paying him for his influence, for his citizenship, for being a clubhouse guy, a leader. And that was one of the things that made it clear that teams were paying attention to character, to the intangibles that a player can bring to the environment.
Yeah, he actually finished with the Padres.
Yeah, that
09.
Was it. Yes.
He was on 08. He was on the 08 Rays team, and I remember talking to Lancaster about that and how big of an influence he was on that 08 Rays team.
Yeah, the Rays had a few players like that, 08, too.
Yeah. I mean, Johnny Gomes was there. I mean, again, come back to Johnny Gomes. Remember him on the bench in the playoffs when he wasn't even on the roster because he wanted to be.
Yeah. And Hinsky.
Yeah.
Joe Maddon and Andrew Friedman talked about the influence that Hinsky had with Evan Longoria. Just kind of brought him out of his shell. But, around that time, and I'm sure general managers for generations have been paying attention to this, but it was interesting to see in the age of Moneyball and sabermetrics that some clubs still were. John Schierholz very much was a culture guy with the Braves. The Twins operated with a culture. The Phillies did. Everywhere Pat Gillick went, he brought that culture mentality too. And of course, you know, I think the most successful organizations do both, understand both, and recognize both. But even while the trend was headed toward analytics, a lot of the teams that succeeded in that period were very overtly recognizing the value of citizens. And I thought it was interesting, too, that Kevin Towers, the guy who got my attention making that move with Cliff Floyd, is, of course, now employed in the Reds front office.
Is there a way to identify that, though? I mean, is it all anecdotal?
To
identify, say, well, I need to bring in somebody to make this over. How do I get Scott Rowland's the guy?
I mean, from the front office?
Yeah,
from the front office.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the challenge? Because, I mean, Skip Schumacher, I think Skip Schumacher's a great guy. I mean, he's a guy I've really enjoyed talking to. I think he's smart. He's been on a lot of good winning teams, and I think that's part of it. And he probably fits this to a T. But Skip Schumacher doesn't fix it. You know, you don't have one guy to really be able to fix it. Is there a way
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole art form.
Yeah.
Most of it, I mean, there. I'm sure in the advanced analytics, there are ways now that front offices can tell what players are contributing more than the mainstream stats will show. Beyond that, yeah, it is anecdotal. You could call it scouting. Knowledge of players, a lot of it is observing players. You can tell things like body language goes a long way. You know, you say, but you know, just think about how body language could affect a team. Use an example like, say, a manager is talking to a club about the way they got to go about their business or whatever, way he wants them to play. And there's a 15-year veteran making $18 million a year who kind of rolls his eyes and looks the other way. Well, a dozen other guys, young guys on the ball club, are going to see that and say, okay, he's rolling his eyes. I guess this manager's full of it. We don't have to pay attention. We don't have to buy in. Just by rolling the eyes. I mean, things like body language speak volumes. And those are the sort of things that scouts and general managers and executives have to pay close attention to. And, I mean, in scouting, it's a whole different area. And I'm sure you're familiar with Tim Nehring. He's around the ballpark a lot. And he speaks to how important it is, whether you're scouting, doing amateur scouting or scouting other teams, to talk to everybody, talk to umpires, family, teammates, everybody who encounters this guy. Tell us what he's like. What does he do to our environment? Mm-hmm. But it's you know, largely anecdotal and observation. And I think as sabermetrics continues to progress and amaze, it will come up with ways to measure things that we think now are not measurable.
You sound like a believer.
Oh, I am. I'm a believer in sabermetrics. I subscribe to it. I think it's stupendous. But I just don't think it can tell the entire story.
You find it funny? I mean, have you followed this? Just the whole thing. I think some of the more, a lot of people I've seen talk about how there used to be this whole thing about how great Adam Dunn is and how bad Juan Pierre is. And now looking back on it, they're like, oh, we were kind of wrong about that. There is a lot of value in Juan Pierre.
Yeah.
And he was the kind of whipping boy for a long time.
Sure.
And now a lot of the same people who were doing the whipping are like, yeah, I was wrong there.
and a guy like Dunn, too, is Pierre to some extent. But Dunn is sort of the classic lightning rod for mm-hmm. the whole discussion. Because his numbers are there. He walks a lot. You know, sabermetricians love the OBP and particularly the walks. And
yeah, making outs is good.
Not the what?
Not making outs is generally seen as positive.
That works. And so he's embraced by that camp. Others would look at his body language, his contact rate, many other things. And so there's probably as much disagreement on the value of Adam Dunn as any player in modern history, particularly any Reds player.
Well, it's funny, and then I think the other player that becomes such a lightning rod, I mean, two of the biggest lightning rods in this whole culture war or whatever, Adam Dunn and Joey Votto.
Yeah.
Of course, the people on the on one side of Joey Votto are kind of losing that argument again. Because
he's so good, basically.
Really good.
Yeah, sure. And, you know,
Is there something about Cincinnati?
The Votto question is interesting too, and I know it's all centered on if a guy of that stature and with his abilities, if he best serves the team by walking to first base when there's an opportunity, maybe drive it. If you watch Votto play though, I've watched this carefully. He plays to situations. He very much understands the situation. He's much less likely to take a walk when it's not appropriate. He knows when he's got to drive in and run. He knows when getting on base makes a difference. I think he's a very good situational hitter, so which to me sort of diffuses the argument against his walks. But the other aspect of it is a guy like it's so vital to surround players with the right players. And that's an example to me of we talked earlier a little bit about the chemistry not only of personalities but of talents.
Mm-hmm.
I think to some extent the Reds have wasted Votto by not pairing him with guys who make a lot of contact and drive the ball into the gaps and can bring him home. Todd Frazier has emerged this year, numbers-wise. He's done some things that are not consistent with the classic cleanup hitter,
right.
However, in terms of driving people in. They need more of those types. It's vital, I think, to complement your talents. You know, like Billy Hamilton, since he's such an extreme, is a good example. It's great to have, particularly if you're playing in big ballparks, which Great American is not, it's great to have fast outfield. Speed, you know, speed versus not speed, speed's better. And people are organizations are applying that in the outfield now. That's great. But if you have Billy Hamilton in center field, is your best move to also look for speed in left and right field? Not only is the speed not quite as necessary in left and right field if you have Billy Hamilton because he covers so much ground, but you're minimizing what Billy Hamilton can contribute.
Right.
Let him use all of that speed to advantage. So if there's somebody, you know, the speed is fine, but if there's somebody you can trade that off for power, for on-base percentage, for whatever, you know, that's your better complementary move. And you asked earlier about what makes baseball so compelling. There's just so many ways to look at it. It's an art form that has so many complexities, nuances, and variations. That's why we like to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Lonnie.
And we've done that for quite a while.
Damage. yeah, we did. That was good, though. So I appreciate it. It's been too long since I've come see you. So.
Well, and you made the trek out here to the next county.
Yeah, let's see if I get home. If I don't, this is going to be the last recording. Somebody will find this in a ditch somewhere. And you know, I love my wife and daughter and hope they are well without me.
I enjoy seeing your... By the way, I remember you years ago, and I will not let you free of this, taunting me about talking about my kids a little bit. Are you ready to take that back now? Mr. My Cute Daughter on Facebook.
Kids are stupid. and by that, I mean me.
All right. I'll forgive.
Yeah, I earned that. I earned every bit of that, too. I earned a lot more, actually. Katzowitz and I.
There you go. Yeah, he's got twins to deal with. Yeah. So
he's got his own problems.
Yeah, so he can do it twice as much. But, yeah. Well, fortunately, your daughter is awfully cute. So,
she is.
So the stuff you post is... entertaining.
Thanks, man.
So that was Lonnie Wheeler, and I hope you enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun for both me and Lonnie. You can find more of these on iTunes, which is where I usually post it, and SoundCloud. I'm sorry again for not being more active here. I've got another couple shows lined up that I think maybe, you know, we'll do some more in the in the off season. I think there's some other stuff to talk about and explore. As far as the live events, we'll look back on those and see if we're going to keep doing those. I've really enjoyed them, but finding a guest has been somewhat of a ordeal. So, anywho, you know, thanks for listening if you get this far. If you got this far, rate and review. Also, check out Lonnie's new book, Intangible. You can get it anywhere. He even has the audio version if you're into that. And, you know, you can rate and review that on Amazon or wherever, iTunes or iBookstore or whatever. And I encourage you to do that and read it and check it out. And it's an interesting read. It has a lot of the Reds in it, so it'll be interesting for a lot of different people. And thanks again for listening and reading on Cincinnati.com.